Accession number 9876, Reel 11.
Mr. Dennis, Reel 11, you were telling me about the effect of this counter-bombardment on two copses occupied by Germans. If you could continue.
When the battery, our batteries, had finished their allotted number of rounds, I don't know what it was, the smoke cleared away and I could see no more German infantry at all. No doubt they'd cleared out anybody who hadn't survived.
What was the actual effect of this concentration? What could you see of the impact of the shells?
Well, I could see we had some. They were quite big shells, of course, ours, and we had one battery with two very big ones, 8-inch, and. I could see large bursts, a flash, and then large bursts of smoke and debris and that. And then a gratifying absence of human activity. I hoped that I had got them, because by this time I was in a mood that I very seldom found myself in the war, and that was, I was really feeling rather vindictive.
What had caused this? Your experiences going up to...
Being frightened in the morning. A feeling that it's time I frightened somebody else. Well, I hope I did. But that finished, and the afternoon went on, and I kept on. I can't remember what messages I sent, but if I saw anything, I told Brigade, and Brigade got through to Corps, and no doubt they collated my information with what they got from other forward serving officers.
That was the only time you had to order them to open fire, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
When you gave the order to open fire, did you provide the map reference, or would they...?
I could give them map reference. I knew the names, and I could give the map reference. I left the rest to the brigade.
Would they be tell the batteries to fire by map reference, would they?
They would tell the batteries to fire by map reference. I was able to see the thing, but I couldn't range the guns. I wasn't in that position.
So as the afternoon wore on...
So the afternoon wore on, and I became... more and more sad in my mind, because I thought to myself that I should be left there. There would be another ferocious barrage in the morning, and if I survived it, I would get stuck by some German with large bayonet or otherwise disposed of. I wondered if I'd have the guts to make any kind of fight, and I wasn't sure. I had no infantry to fight with me.
There were no signs of the infantry in the front line still, then?
No, they must have been somewhere, but they weren't round me.
Would they be in the dugouts, or...?
There may have been some there. Next day we saw infantry, of course. But no, it's... Well, very much to my... relief. I can't tell you how much. At nightfall, I got an order from Brigade to come back and report there. I realized I was not going to be left to be massacred in the morning. So I went back to Brigade. By this time, there was no shelling to speak of. The Germans, I suppose, were busy bringing their guns forward for next morning, and I reported at brigade and then I went back to my battery and had a good night's sleep.
So as far as you could see, the attack that where in this particular sector of the line, the German attack hadn't got through to the battle zone.
What the German attack had done was to clear the forward zone completely and put them in a position to rush the battle zone next morning. Strangely, I read an extract from a German account years later in which they said that a mistake they had made was in not seizing the Bois d'Aulnon on the first day. They said that it was one of the 6 points which on the 3rd and 5th Army fronts, our 3rd and 5th Army fronts, which mattered most, and they should have had it. Well, as I said, they could have had it. There was no possibility of our stopping them. So I suppose, sticking to their plan, instead of exploiting the chance, was helped us. Well, I got back to the battery, as I say. Next morning, shall I get on to next morning? Now, the battery was divided into 2 sections, each of 2 guns. My section was a bit farther forward and had been dug into a position which could just be reached by, I suppose, a couple of hours hauling on the drag ropes to get off the road. The main part of the battery, the other 2 guns with the commanding officer, were a little farther back and not in quite such a bad position. I believe it to be true, but I can't give you chapter and verse, that a number of commanders of batteries, heavy batteries, had urged on the command to allow them to get somewhere where they could be picked up, because they realized we couldn't hold. But owing to some stupidity, I think I know who is responsible.
Who's that?
The Corps CRO, the Corps Staff Officer in charge of the heavy batteries. I think he was responsible. But I say, you know, I shouldn't go on record in that way. It's an inference, it's not evidence. But anyway, in the morning, the Germans were clean through the battle zone in no time, and they were coming into the battery area.
Did you have a forward observation officer forward from
not
your
that
battery?
Time, no. We didn't, but I did suggest to this one of the times when we had a captain, I did suggest to the captain who was in charge at my section that I might go out in front and see if I could what I could see and how long we'd got and that kind of thing. And so I went out in front and I saw at some considerable distance, I must say, small parties of our troops slowly retiring one after another from one position to another, followed by larger groups of Germans and a lot of machine gun fire and all this. And I realized that our time was going to be very short. So I came back and I said, look, I think we'd better have these guns out of action since we can't take them away. Incidentally, they didn't send our lorries up to get us, so even if we could have spent the 2 hours pulling them into onto the road, we couldn't have got them away. So I said, Henry, better do something with these, at any rate prevent them from being used. And he said, yes, we will. We will let all the pressure out of the gun cylinders, and they, we'll then fire them with a full charge so that they'll break the cylinder, and then if we attack the screw part of the breech with a cold chisel, that would probably make it impossible to shut the breech anyway. So they got doing this, and the captain said, you take all the men you can and get back with them. I shall stay here with the battery anti-aircraft Lewis gun and see if I can get anybody before they before we get driven away. Well, I don't know what happened to him, but he and his men got back, and I hope they got somebody on the way. I took the other men. We found a lorry on the road. It hadn't come to fetch us, but it was available, and it took us aboard. I think it may have been two lorries, but anyway, we got aboard, and I could hear a bit of whistling, which I think came from badly aimed rifle fire, but it did us no harm. We got back to find that we men got back minus our guns, having scandalously cast them away in face of the enemy, as the old charge was. We found that the other section had got both its guns out, and we were joined up with another battery that was short of guns, so that we could get a complete battery going. And 2 days later we got our new guns sent up by the ordnance, so we could be on our own again.
Like you say, it's almost a ridiculous thing. Was there any question of you being told to stay with the two guns and fighting it out rather than disabling them?
No one suggested that we should do anything of that kind. That was a later occasion on which we were told to stay, but that was but on this occasion obviously we were doing what was meant.
After you rejoined your own battery,
yes,
and the what was left of it,
yes,
you carried on retreating, did you?
Oh yes. What followed was that for the next few days it was more or less the same pattern. We found some place where we could level enough and hard enough to unlimber the guns, because by this time we'd got four-wheel drive lorries too, so we could go with them. And what we generally did, since we could get no orders from Corps at all, was that we sent an officer to find the nearest infantry, see where they were, and fire on any place that might help them. For instance, we thought we could help them probably by firing on all the crossroads that led up to where they were. So we used to do that. And this was what we did. We retreated, of course, over the Somme and and we were going continually southwest, and it looked rather nasty because there was this chronic shortage of infantry. There were terrible stories, I believe, in England about mobs of terrified people rushing away, but I didn't see any, and I don't think it happened.
Well, the roads weren't crowded then?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
You weren't impeded by...
Oh, good question, nothing like that happened. There were no civilians in that part of the world to crowd the roads. And our own were all right. One episode occurred on my birthday, my 21st birthday. That's the 25th of March. In the morning, we got orders from the brigade to fire on some map references they gave us and keep firing on them as long as possible, and that we could withdraw when all the other batteries in the area had gone. Now, all the other batteries in the area did go, except one. And that was not an English battery, but a French 75mm battery, horse-drawn. And they were in front of us and a little bit to a flank. And taking our orders literally, I suppose, we ought to have waited till they went. So I thought I'd better go, and with the blessing of my commanding officer, I went to the French. I was supposed to be able to talk some French, which was, well, in the moment. And I found them quite cheerful, and I asked them whether they could tell me what their intentions were. And they said, well, we're going to stay here and we're going to fire until the Germans get on the crest immediately opposite us. And then we're going to limber up and get away. And what are you going to do? And I said, well, our orders were to stay there until everyone else had gone, and then we could get away. And the Frenchman said to me, that's foolish, you know. It'll take you a couple of hours to get out of this position. If I were you, I should beat it. So I went back to the battery, knowing that my bloodthirsty major would probably suggest that we fought the Germans with the rammers of the guns or something of that kind. But at that point we ran out of ammunition, so everybody's feelings were satisfied and we got away. And the French battery, I was very glad to see, got away too.
Was there a shortage of food and ammunition during the retreat?
No. We were always able to get ammunition, and we were always able to get enough food.
Where from? Because
it came up from the rear.
So the communication...
It was still fairly well organised, you know. Lorries came up with rations and found us somehow. No, the thing was never a flight. It was a retreat, a very past retreat, and one which we had no option but to do, because we were continually finding that the Germans had got through where there were no infantry and were firing on us from the back. Not that we had any particularly serious, not me personally, not, but that was happening to our infantry, that they were always getting infiltrated through. And this is one reason why I feel so bitter about all the troops who were in England.
You do feel bitter about that? Can you explain that?
Still, I still feel very, very bad about that. The only reason why there were these masses of troops in England was that Lloyd George didn't trust Haig, was afraid that if he sent them over to France, Haig would start an offensive with them. And so he landed us into this mess. And then he tried to make a scapegoat of one of the army generals. In fact, he did.
What, Gough?
Gough, who was made the scapegoat for what was not his fault.
He was your army commander, wasn't
he? My army commander then.
Did you feel that the Fifth Army under his command had fought as well as could be expected? Or?
I had my reservations about Gough because I thought he hadn't handled the Ypres offensive properly. He had allowed it to go on in small and very expensive minor operations, and it ought to have been stopped. But I was quite clear that he was in no way responsible for what happened on the St. Quentin front, and that he was sacrificed because he was there and a natural target. He wasn't my favourite commander, but he wasn't like the funny old man Plumer, who really was Plumer Second Army, who really was good. I mean, he looked like an absurd old figure out of Dad's Army, and he's all sort of white whiskers and red face and all this, but he really knew how to do his job, and he had an extremely good chief of staff too.
So this retreat, as it went back, how many days were you retreating?
I can't tell you the exact number, but I had my birthday, that's the 25th of March, 26th, 27th, about the 28th, I think. We were near a place called Montdidier.
During the retreat, what had you done in the evening? Had you carried on retreating, or would you make do with some billets?
If there was any convenient place to stop, we did. We were not far enough in front to stand any risk of being overrun in the night. Where we used to go was some place where we could give support to the infantry, but we didn't go among them. I suppose it must have been in the early days of April that we were at Montdidier, exhausted. But
did you get any support from the French? You mentioned this French 75.
No, that was earlier. Now this is what happened. We heard that the French were coming up. These were the divisions which had been promised when we took over part of the French front. The French had not played quite fair with us, really, because they had left the divisional headquarters in the places agreed upon, and they had taken the men and their arms away eastward with the old aim of covering Paris. You know, this all reproduced itself in the Second War in a disastrous way. But we told the French were coming. And there arrived a mob of excited soldiers, some drunk, shouting, and I could make out the shouting that they didn't see why they should be coming up. Help the bloody English. In fact, when they got within a distant, a long machine gun range of the Germans, they turned and fled, and they simply ran for it. These were unfortunate. It was one of the divisions which had been involved in the Nivelle mutinies, and it hadn't been cured. Most of them had been rested and refitted and were said to be all right again, but these were not, and off they went.
Now, you saw evidence of this lack of discipline.
I did. Oh, yes, I could see them only too well. I also did something which I shouldn't have done. I don't know if it's worth record, but here it is. One chap shouted to me, one of the French, shouted to me rude words, the effect that he didn't see why they should be put in danger to save the British. And in any case, what was the good of this war, which they'd come into for our sakes? And at this point, I said to him, "But surely you know, don't you, that the reason for this war was to recover Alsace-Lorraine for the French?" And burst into rage and shrieked with fury, and the column moved away. But it was not a thing to. I shouldn't have. However,
Did they have any political complexion to their?
Oh Lord, yes. They were full of they were full of sort of communist slogans and that kind of thing. Oh, they'd been well impregnated.
Were they influenced at all, do you think, by the Russian Revolution?
Oh,
what
yes.
You saw?
I'm sure they were. I can't give you personal evidence of this, but where they mutinied on the French front, some of them tried to form Soviets, and the French shot them rather freely too. They ran away, and next day a really good French division arrived. I can't be quite certain whether it was Algerian or Moroccan, but it was a French colonial division. It was dismounted cavalry, and there's a call around the brigade, anybody who can speak any French, and that was me. So I was sent to report to the French divisional commander, and I wish I could remember his name, because he was not only very pleasant to me, but I thought he was extremely good at his job. He gave me a drink out of his very good wine out of his own flask, and asked me how old I was, and I nearly fainted when I told him I'd just become 21, because of course French never had had officers of that age, and possibly we'd better not, I don't know, but anyway. Then I went to his artillery commander, and he showed me a map and pointed out to me places that they would like fire on. I got through to the brigade and gave him the places, and our guns pooped off. And then the French divisional commander decided to have some limited counterattacks to try to hold the Germans up, and I went with him, and I was very impressed with what he did, because he went right forward into the thick of everything. He had a telephone reel line backwards, nothing else. And he took up his position on a little sort of little kind of hill, just at the place where the French columns broke up into small bodies to do their counterattacks. And jolly efficient they were. But we were rather conspicuous. And we got seen on this hill. And the Germans then started to shell us. I thought to myself, I've got to behave myself, because in the middle of all these French staff officers, I really can't be the first person to throw myself down. And I suppose they thought that they couldn't be the first person to throw themselves down with a wretched English subaltern present. So nobody threw themselves down, and it was very nasty. And then the general decided to move away, so it was relieved. But he did know.